Hello and welcome to our weekly podcast of Who's Here in the Hamptons. I'm Dan Rettiner, your host, broadcasting from my home in the Hamptons, where I have lived for over 55 years. I've written a dozen books about this glorious place, and I've seen it grow through the years from small tourist towns, quaint fishing villages, and a summer playground for high society, to what it is today, a world-class resort for celebrities, artists, musicians, authors, and billionaires. In my podcast, I will bring you interviews with not only these people, but also prominent local people who have helped shape the Hamptons. Welcome to Dan's Talks. My guest today is Wilbur Ross, who is former Secretary of Commerce and who lives in Palm Beach in Southampton. I think you're in Southampton today.
Yes.
Wilbur served for 4 years under Donald Trump. And he's written a book because over the course of his life, he's had an extraordinary group of experiences. And they involve travel to China and Japan and all sorts of things. And I want to briefly summarize what I know of your career. You were for a long time the chief operating officer of Rothschilds and would take businesses through bankruptcy. But this would be businesses that were failing and then restore them. And then Rothschilds would restructure them. And from that, you did that for how long? About 10 years?
No, longer than that, yes.
And is that sort of where it all learned from? Because after that, you went off on your own.
That's correct.
And I will have to say that you're a legend in this field and that you have published, you've written a book, which is going to be out this month, I think in the 15th, which is called Risks and Returns, which is zeroed in on what you do and what you learned. So tell us a little about the book, and then we'll talk more about your life and what you do now.
Okay, fine, Dan. Well, actually, the book comes out officially on the 10th of September. So it's a little bit sooner than what you perhaps had thought. But the book is fundamentally an autobiography, but it's an autobiography that tries to take a lot of the interesting anecdotes that I've experienced and draw some meaning from them that could be useful to other people, whether they're at an early stage of their career or at a later stage, and also whether they're at a relatively early stage of their life or at a later stage. So it's meant to be something that's both amusing and helpful.
Can you give one example of something old that you said was an event that might be helpful to others?
Sure. When I was very young, I was quite scrawny and quite a bookworm. And as you can see, I haven't improved very much since then. As a result, I had a big feeling of insecurity, and I was a very good target for bullies. Ultimately, my father got me a punching bag and some instruction, and then it's not that I had to use the punching too many times, but it gave me the self-confidence to project strength, and it mostly did away with anybody wanting to be a bully. And I think the lesson from that is one that people should use throughout their life, whether it's a grammar school bully blocking your way to class, or in later life, if it's a foreign bully trying to take over territory or take unfair advantage of you in some way. A bully can only be a bully if they have a willing victim. And that was a very important message to me.
Can you relate that to your trips to China when you were in the government?
Sure. The Chinese are a very nationalistic people and are very determined to get ahead. They're very hardworking. And while the government is communist and going toward dictatorship, the people themselves haven't lost their mercantile instinct. So you have a tension between what's going on in the actual economy and what's happening in the political sector. And what that has led to fairly recently is quite a few Chinese entrepreneurs have left the country because President Xi has found out that it's very hard to control successful entrepreneurs, especially if they have a lot of money outside the country. So we're seeing played out in real life the same kind of psychodrama that I was exposed to when I was a kid.
Where did you grow up and what was your interest? Was it always business and that sort of thing?
Well, certainly not surfing, but when I was growing up, I wanted to be...
Where was it?
Oh, it was in North Bergen, New Jersey,
oh.
A little town up on the Palisades between the George Washington Bridge and the Lincoln Tunnel. So when I was growing up, my dream was to be a fiction writer. And when I got to Yale, I did well enough in English Lit in the first year that they let me go into a course called Daily Themes. And what it consisted of was every day by 10 o'clock, you had to put in a little mail slot, at least 1,000 words of fiction or poetry. And after about 2 weeks, I was totally out of material, even by my own reckoning. So I quit the course and instead started to pursue a Wall Street career. And so that course at Yale saved me from a life of poverty.
I see. Especially today when the media is shrinking in many ways.
Well, yeah. And so in one sense, this book, 60-odd years later, is wish fulfillment of my early childhood dream. Difference is, though, this book is factual. It's not fiction, even though some of the anecdotes may be hard to believe.
Talk about what you did after you went. I know it was back to Harvard, and you got the double law and business school degree.
Yes. Yeah.
And
well,
what did you do after that?
Well, I had been in ROTC while I was at Yale for two reasons. One, in those days, we had universal military training, aka the draft, and I felt it would be more interesting to go in as an officer than as a private. But the other reason, and maybe the more important one, was ROTC paid you a little stipend each month, and that effectively was my spending money.
I see. What business did you get into from there?
Okay, well, that's a great story and a great anecdote. When I went to business school, the Army agreed to defer my military service until I finished. And the firm, a very hot-shot go-go money manager called Imre DeVay, agreed that I could postpone joining his firm until after I got out of the military. Problem was, the week before I joined him, having just left the military, he died. And on his bedside, he sold the business to Robert Winthrop, a very wealthy man from Massachusetts who had been one of his big clients. So I suddenly changed jobs, or at least changed employers, and I hadn't even yet gotten a paycheck. A couple of weeks later, in came Jack Dorrance, who then was the CEO of Campbell Soup and a very wealthy man, and the head of his pension fund. And they were there to see whether they wanted to continue having several billion dollars of money invested with that firm. So they're having a nice social lunch. And then after it, Dorrance started asking some questions about the portfolio. And at one point he asked Mr. Winthrop, do all of my accounts, why do all of my accounts have Lucky silver mines in it, Lucky Friday silver mine? And Mr. Winthrop turned and asked me, Wilbur, do my accounts have Lucky Friday in them as well? And I said, yes, sir, all of our accounts do, and here's why. And I gave the explanation. Dorrance asked a few little questions, and then he said, well, thank you, and now I understand it. I've heard enough for today. And so he terminated the lunch. The following Monday, they pulled all of their accounts out because it was clear to him that this was not the same kind of money management that they had been used to before. So that created a problem. $3 billion of accounts, a lot to lose all in one shot. So later on that week, Mr. Winthrop was at a Citibank board meeting, and this was when Dick Perkins was running Citibank. And he explained his problem to Perkins, and Perkins said, well, I have a great solution for you. Sam Milbank wants to pull his capital out of Wood Struthers, nice old line investment firm. And if you take a few million more of your dollars, buy out his capital, they'll make it Wood Struthers and Winthrop, and nobody will ever again put you on the spot about things like Lucky Friday silver mines. So now I change jobs again. And what happened here, DeVay had had a venture capital fund as one of its activities. Wood Struthers people decided to exit the business, that business. So they fired the man who had been running it. They put one of their partners nominally as the president, made me a vice president, and gave me the task of liquidating this portfolio within a 2-year period. And with the promise that there'd be a good bonus at the end of it, provided that it never had to put any more capital in, and provided there was no litigation. So along the way, I learned how to work companies through the distress process, because these companies ranged from a couple very successful ones that we sold for pretty high prices to ones that were total failures, to ones that were just struggling. So I spent the 2 years really learning a whole new trade, the whole trade of workout. And that was how I got my start in distressed securities.
Well, after a long period doing that for Rothschilds, you struck out on your own. And as I recall from reading about it, that you began to invest in these companies yourself, W.L. Ross and Company, and you owned steel mills and clothing factories and all sorts of interesting and difficult businesses that needed workouts of one kind or another. One of which was, I believe you represented the stockholders at the Taj Mahal in, that was owned by Donald Trump at the time, in Atlantic City.
Yes, the Taj Mahal was a company we didn't invest ourselves. This was in the earlier days when I was just doing advisory. Yeah. What happened was Trump was financing the casino mainly with $800 million of first mortgage bonds which was interesting that the underwriters were able to sell them, because this was a startup casino. It had not been in business before.
Yeah.
Anyhow, the casino had very big overruns in cost, and as a result, the bonds never paid a single coupon. They defaulted before the first semiannual coupon was due. Well, that made the bondholders very angry, obviously enough. So they hired me to try to get what they could back from Trump. And so we had a fairly acrimonious set of discussions that really began almost the minute that they hired me. They hired me on the Thursday before Labor Day weekend. And as soon as he got word, Trump called me and said, "You must come to Atlantic City tomorrow, then we'll start the discussions." Well, the last thing in the world I wanted was to be in Atlantic City on Labor Day weekend. I wanted to be out in Southampton, where I normally would be. But being a new relationship, I felt I couldn't just say, "No, I don't feel like doing it." So I show up at the 63rd Street helipad in New York City, and there is this gleaming silver-like helicopter, and on the side of it in 6-foot-high nail polish red letters was emblazoned TRUMP. So at least I knew I had found the right helicopter. So 30 minutes later, we land in Atlantic City. Trump greets me at the helipad, right about 100 feet from his casino, because the casino was right on the boardwalk. And as I get in the car, I notice it had two flags on the front bumper. One was naturally the American flag. The other was a Trump flag. And it looked to me like the Trump flag was maybe a little bit larger than the American flag. So we then go to the casino, and there was this people swarming all over, dying for a look at Donald, getting video cams of him, all this stuff. We go into the casino, and within the casino, even more excitement showed up. People were asking him to sign their beanie caps, sign their notepads, and in fact, one woman in an open back dress asked him to sign her back. Now, what she would do with a Trump signature on her back, I have no idea. But in any event, we then went upstairs and we started our debate. And it didn't go very well in the beginning. Trump said, "The bonds are trading at 20 cents on the dollar right now, and your clients will be lucky if they can get 20 cents out. Agree to that now, and I'll get you your 20 cents. I said, "Well, Donald, that's not what they hired me to do. They hired me to get 100 cents plus interest." So we debated back and forth for a couple hours, and he wasn't moving at all. So I finally said, "Well, Donald, is that it? You're stuck, at least for right now, at 20 cents. And he said, "Yes, that's right." So I said, "Well, goodbye. I'm going up to New York. I'm not going to waste my weekend here debating, because we're never going to take 20 cents. And so I walked out on him. Now, he was a little amazed at that, because that's the kind of tactic that he might use. So it was a little surprising to him to have someone use it on him. And in a good-natured way, he tells that story to today. So it's not something that's just joking. Anyway, so then we resume discussions. And again, it's very acrimonious. He's saying he's going to get the bondholders to fire me. And I'm saying he wants a Christmas present, and it's not even Halloween, let alone Christmas. So we went back and forth. And when we finally made a deal months later, we had a huge press conference at the Plaza Hotel, which had been one of his hotels. And it went very nicely, and there was a lot of coverage and all that. So I'm coming out of the press conference, I get in the limo, and I get a phone call. "This is your mother." And she said it in just about that strained tone. I said, "Well, hello, Mom, how are you?" And she said, "I've been playing Mahjong with my friends, and we all agree you've lost all your self-respect."
Oh,
I
Mom.
Said, "What do you mean, Mom? I don't know what you're talking about." She said, "Well, after all those mean things he said about you, you never should have made a deal with Donald Trump. And if you had just become a lawyer like your father was and like I always wanted you to be, you wouldn't have to hang around with people like that." So that was how I got to meet Donald Trump. And
but then years later, you were offered the job because of all of the success you had restructuring businesses to be his Secretary of Commerce, and you took it.
Yes, yes. When we had become friendly intervening years.
Yes.
And interestingly, Carl Icahn was the largest of the bondholders. Carl naturally had not bought the bonds at par. He bought them when they were down around 20 cents. And so he and I were banded together in the struggle against Trump. And interestingly, both Carl and I turned out to support him. And there's a good reason for that. When you're dealing with the adverse party in a bankruptcy, you get to know what they're really made of.
Yeah.
And Icahn and I both were impressed enough that we eventually decided that he was somebody we would back for president.
Did you feel that way after Mr. Biden came in and then you weren't there anymore?
Well, when Biden was elected, naturally, he wanted his own cabinet. And so we got fired. First time in my life I was ever fired.
But no, I meant, did it change your thinking about the 4 years, about how you felt about Mr. Trump after that?
Well, ultimately, I actually was retained by him in some other matters. So I knew him better and better over the years. And what I finally concluded in the first election campaign against Hillary Clinton, what I concluded was he was the only candidate either in the Republican side or the Democratic side who understood how fed up middle America and lower middle class people were with the fact that they had lost purchasing power steadily over the prior decades.
Yeah.
And I felt, since he was the only one who seemed to understand the problem, he was likely the only one who could figure out how to fix it.
Did so after leaving, you've gone back to your home down in, I remember you here in the Hamptons where you've come for the summers as president of the Southampton Bath and Tennis Club. What do you like to do when you're out here with your wife?
Well, in those early days, I did some sailing and played quite a little bit of tennis. And then once in a while, I would shoot basketball hoops with you in your backyard. Nowadays, because it's easier on my legs, I do much more swimming than I do tennis. And I gave up sailing quite a few years back. So it's a little bit more passive activity. But the other activity here now is we have some grandchildren who occasionally come and visit us, and it's fun. playing with a little four-year-old.
Oh, yeah.
As I regress back to an infant mentality, I'm more or less there equal.
And how is Risk and Returns, the name of the book, being early received? Do you think it's going to be a book that people would benefit from?
And I do, because I did overcome a lot of hardships and overcame them by focus, by studying, and by determination and hard work.
Okay, well, we'll leave it at that. And I want to thank you for being on the podcast. And I hope to see you soon.
Thank you, Dan. Have a good day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.